From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, around the world in 30 blocks, we start a year-long tour of the amazing range of restaurants on Sacramento's Broadway. Plus, jazz saxophonist and clarinetist Anat Cohen, she and her young band are playing Davis this week. But first, an 8.0 earthquake damaged a bridge in Reno this morning. But don't worry, it was a simulated quake, and the bridge was a scale size, but still quite big replica. Here's what the high point sounded like. The goal of this morning's experiment was to find out what kind of construction most resists destruction. Joining us by phone from Reno and in transit from Reno back to Sacramento are a variety of people who worked on or observed the experiment. We'll start with engineering professor Saeed Saeedi, who's the leader, the principal investigator of this experiment. Saeed Saeedi, welcome to Insight.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Could you describe the experiment to us first, what the bridge looked like and how big it is?
The bridge model itself is 110 foot long. It's a four-span bridge supported on three piers, and we have the abutments as well. The piers, each one of them consists of two columns. So a total of six columns supported the bridge plus the end support at the abutment.
And how did you create the simulated earthquake?
This is done through the shake cable system that we have here at the University of Nevada, Reno. It's a very unique, exceptional kind of equipment. We have four shake tables that allow us to simulate earthquake. These are high-capacity shake tables. Each shake table has a capacity of 50-ton payload that allows us to build large models of bridges and other structures and test them under a simulated earthquake. There's a very advanced hydraulic system with the advanced control system that allows us to replicate the recorded earthquakes that we have had in the past or any other artificial earthquake that we may decide to generate.
You were trying out several construction designs, is that right?
That is correct. In this project is funded by the National Science Foundation. And our goal, one of the goals of the project is to look at innovative, advanced details, the kind of details that have not been used in bridges before. The objective being to minimize damage during the earthquake. Now, current design procedures for bridges under seismic loading, they have a target performance. That performance, the target performance is that the bridge should not collapse. But the bridge is designed so that it will be severely damaged. Now, that could create a problem for the community, for the highway network where this bridge is located. A bridge which is highly damaged would have to be shut down to traffic. That could affect the local emergency response vehicle passage, such as fire trucks as well as ambulances. Also, because it's shutting down the highway network, it could have a major economic impact locally, regionally, nationally, even internationally.
Mm-hmm.
So our goal in this project was to use these advanced innovative materials that have not been used in bridges so that to make the bridge not only safe during the earthquake, but also make the bridge usable after the earthquake.
We're talking about an earthquake simulation this morning at University of Nevada, Reno. Saeed Saeedi is an engineering professor there and the principal investigator in this experiment. What did you find? Did any particular construction design or material stand out for the better?
Absolutely. First of all, we were able to do this experiment today, compare these new designs that we have developed with conventional construction. And we saw that all the new designs performed much better than conventional construction. So that was lesson one. But among these, there are three different new designs that we explored. One of them, I'd say, has been further developed, has been attempted by other universities on single columns. We found that one did well in some respects in terms of preventing permanent tilt of the bridge. It prevented that. However, there was still severe damage to it to the point that you would still have to shut down the bridge to traffic.
Mm-hmm. I see.
The other two details, one used nickel-titanium material as well as some fiber concrete. It performed well. There was another detail where we used the rubber pad as part of the column. They were built into the column. And we found that that detail also worked very well. There's very little damage in the areas where we used the rubber pad, also in the area where we used nickel titanium and fiber concrete.
Let's bring into the conversation another researcher at University of Nevada, Reno. Glenn Biasi is a research seismologist. Glenn, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
How realistic is a simulated earthquake like the one that happened this morning?
These are, I think, very important tests to run. How realistic are they? The engineers would take actual, and they have access to actual recorded ground motions. So these might be famous ground motion records, possibly from Oakland or from the Loma Prieta earthquake or others. So these are the types of inputs that you can instruct the tables to say, dear table, shake this bridge with this earthquake. So they can be very realistic.
But earthquakes often happen deep under the ground, and there are many different kinds of earthquakes, and they spread their energy over a huge area. How can you simulate that in a lab?
Well, the actual recordings that we make in seismology in a discipline both in California, Nevada, and elsewhere are the delivered energy. So, yes, earthquakes start deep, but by the time you record them at the surface, but that surface is like a place where a guy could build a bridge. And so if you measure at the surface and you design a bridge at the surface, the input can look very much like an earthquake, even though the earthquake was perhaps far away or deeper or elsewhere.
How many different, generally speaking, how many different kinds of earthquakes are, and which is the most destructive?
Generally, they're divided into three broad classes. In California, the most are the earth sliding one past another, and they're called strike-slip earthquakes. Another one proceeds under, and another, they're called thrust earthquakes, and these happen at the in Japan and Indonesia and places of this sort. And then in the basin and range, where the earth is pulling apart and it makes valleys in between, and the piece in the middle drops. Among those, I think the thrust earthquakes and their related form, it's called a reverse earthquake, like the Northridge earthquake, are, I think, considered the most dangerous.
Yes. Saeed Saidi, which kind of earthquake or earthquakes did you simulate today?
The record that we used for today came from the 1994 Northridge earthquake in Southern California. So we took one of those records that and we de-amplified it for some smaller motions, and we amplified it. We made it stronger and stronger towards the ladder motion. So the motion that we did today, in terms of acceleration intensity, was twice as strong as what we had during the Northridge earthquake.
I see. Now, well, let's bring into the conversation Mike Kiever of Caltrans, the California Department of Transportation. He's the head of Caltrans's Office of Earthquake Engineering. He observed the experiment today. He joins us by cell phone, I think somewhere on Interstate 80. Mike Kiever, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Why were you in Reno today to watch this experiment? What did you and Caltrans hope to learn?
Well, as you know, California is very seismically active, and obviously, as we've seen in the Loma Prieta, Northridge, and other earthquakes, we have had bridges damaged in those earthquakes. We've learned a lot from past research, and we've applied that with our seismic retrofit program to improve the performance of our bridges. But the unique details that were being tested today have promised to provide us with the opportunity perhaps to not close bridges after an earthquake and to keep traffic moving.
Are you specifically looking at some of the materials that were tested today to use them in bridges and freeway overpasses in California?
It may be a bit premature. We certainly are very interested in waiting for Professor Saidi to complete his analysis and reviewing the data and writing his report. we have a very good relationship with the University of Nevada, Reno, and I'm sure Professor Saidy will be sharing that report with us. From there, we have a technical earthquake committee that reviews research reports, and then we take those and we look at how we might want to apply those in California.
Yes. Would this, I realize it's still early, but would any new designs or new materials, would these be for future bridges and overpasses, or would they be for retrofitting existing ones?
I believe the types of details we were looking at would be primarily for our newer types of bridges, although it may be possible to modify existing bridges to use some of the concepts, but I think it would be primarily for our newer bridges.
And our fourth and final guest on this topic is Manos Maragakis, who's Dean of Engineering at University of Nevada, Reno. Dean Maragakis, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. My pleasure to be on it.
Why is University of Nevada, Reno so interested and involved in this kind of earthquake and engineering research?
Well, this is, first of all, Nevada has a great interest in earthquakes, and we do have our seismology program in the College of Science and the earthquake engineering in our College of Engineering. This is a program that we have focused in developing the last 25 years. It has a national and international profile, state-of-the-art facilities. We collaborate with major universities, provides great opportunities for our graduate students to receive degrees involved in high-profile projects such as this one, and also it involves many contractors outside the university. It contributes to the economic diversification of the states, and it enhances the reputation of the university, and it does provide compelling arguments and results in order to facilitate implementation later on in bridge codes and influence the state of new construction or retrofitting old bridges. So it's a great program, and it is an exemplary program for our college and for every other college, as a matter of fact.
This the bridge that was being experimented on today, quote-unquote bridge, is about 110 feet long and weighs 200 tons. That must cost an awful lot of money and require a special place to put it.
Yes. Well, as Dr. Saidy mentioned, we do have a very one of the biggest laboratory facilities in the United States. We do have the forsake tables, which are spread along the lab, and they are high capacity, so they can accommodate such a big specimen. And of course, as I said, it involves these are very expensive specimens, and they involve heavy and detailed construction, and they involve many contractors outside the university.
Finally, Saeed Saidy,
yes.
What was it like when the full force of the earthquake hit this morning, the simulated earthquake on this bridge? What was it like being around that?
Well, your heartbeat certainly goes up, especially when you have a whole bunch of visitors. It's close to 100 visitors in the laboratory, and you're concerned about safety and everything else. We had excellent safety device. But it's because this is research, you cannot completely be sure about what to expect.
Yes.
And so that was the exciting part of it. But fortunately, everything went well, and we were able to get a great deal of good information that will be very useful.
And Mike Kiever, same question to you. What was it like for you when it actually hit its full force?
In many ways, it was reassuring. Like Dr. Saidy said, that this is a very large earthquake simulation, and there was a lot of movement of that bridge. But we were able to see with both the conventional details that showed damage, but still were able to maintain the bridge's integrity. And then rather exciting when you look at the new details that were developed and find that there was very little damage. So we were quite excited and happy to be there.
Well, thank you all very much. We've been talking about the simulated 8.0 earthquake on a scale-sized bridge at University of Nevada, Reno this morning. By all accounts, it went well. Saeed Saidy is an engineering professor at the campus and the principal investigator in this experiment. Manos Maragakis is dean of engineering at UNR. Glenn Biazzi is a research seismologist at UNR. And Mike Kiever, who joins us by cell phone on Interstate 80, is a Caltrans earthquake engineering official who attended the experiment. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Thanks to Capital Public Radio news reporter Ben Adler, who was in Reno today and recorded what happened. You can see a picture of the experimental bridge at our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Coming up, around the world in 30 blocks, we start a year-long tour of the amazing range of restaurants on Sacramento's Broadway. We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can listen to Insight live online. To stream our show, go to capradio.org/insight. FEMA just published its new flood maps for Sacramento's Natomas Basin, and that means higher flood insurance for many people there. Tomorrow in Insight, we'll talk about this with Sacramento's top flood control official. Also, why bird watchers here and across the country go out one morning every December to count as many birds as they can. And playwright Sands Hall, her adaptation of Little Women, is playing in Nevada City. Walk or drive down Sacramento's Broadway and you'll soon notice the astonishing and global variety of restaurants. There are so many, it's the subject of a year-long series starting tomorrow morning on Capital Public Radio. Food reporter Elaine Korn is visiting 12 ethnically varied restaurants and meeting the people behind them. Assisting her with the project is urban geographer Robin Dattle of Sacramento State. They're both in our studio. Elaine Korn, Robin Dattle, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
Elaine, let's start with the inspiration for this. It started, I guess, with a story you did a few years ago about a bunch of bingers on Broadway.
Yes, the Broadway Bistro Binge was a collection of, turns out, Third Appellate Court justices who every Wednesday had decided that since they lived in the Broadway neighborhood, that the best way to get to know their neighborhood was to eat at every single restaurant on Broadway, no matter how grungy or what it looked like, they were going to go. And that's what they did.
And here's a clip from that story from 2005.
By the time they were done, the culinary microcosm that is uniquely Broadway's had fed the bingers at 26 restaurants. They'd encountered at least 10 distinct cuisines and as many dialects.
Oh, we've eaten all around the world, up and down the street.
No surprise, in a city ranked as one of the most ethnically diverse in the country.
We had, first was Chinese, we had Kathmandu from Nepal, Jamaican.
Joe Marty's roasted chicken.
The peanut duck at Hong Kong Cafe is to die for.
That's an excerpt from a story Elaine Korn did for Capital Public Radio a few years ago. Elaine, how did you go from that seed of an idea to doing this grand tour of the global array of restaurants on Broadway?
Actually, when you can't get something out of your mind, that's when you know you have to seize it and do something about it. I couldn't get what these people did, not only could I not get it out of my mind, but it meant something more to me than it did at the time. They were having such a great time eating at all these places, and I began to see this melting pot, this stew on Broadway, as a reflection of the population in Sacramento, and that if you can examine the way people are, where they come from, what they're like, one of the best windows into a culture is their food. And so I decided, you know, let's go a little deeper into some of these restaurants on Broadway and see what the cuisine says about the people.
Elaine Korn's year-long series, Broadway, Around the World in 30 Blocks, starts tomorrow during Morning Edition on Capital Public Radio. She's a food writer and cookbook author and often does stories about food for Capital Public Radio. Collaborating with Elaine on this is Robin Dattle, Associate Professor of Geography and Chair of the Geography Department at Sacramento State. She's an urban geographer. Robin, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I'm going to start with the question, what is urban geography?
Urban geography is the study of the character of cities, how they come to be as a result of interaction between the physical environment and all the different groups of people that come to live there. And it's also particularly interested in spatial patterns and why certain things come to be in the city at certain places. And I think there's a really interesting story to tell about why this particular restaurant function has ended up on Broadway.
Well, specifically then, how does urban geography relate to this project that Elaine is working on, touring restaurants and talking to people at these varied ethnic restaurants on Broadway?
Well, I think, first of all, that food is a particularly non-threatening way for Sacramentans to meet one another. And I'm on a mission to teach people about the city and about one another, and I think food is a way to do that, both our students at Sac State and the larger public. But Broadway is in a very interesting location if you look at the social geography on either side of it. To the north are the working class and immigrant neighborhoods and homes to some of the people who started these restaurants over the years and the people who work in them. And to the south is a upper middle class, well-educated, adventuresome eating group like
Land Park and Curtis Park,
like the people that Elaine took her initial idea from. And so Broadway is where these two groups come together and interact. And so I think that's one reason why Broadway has emerged as this ethnic restaurant zone. Broadway is also part of what geographers call the frame of the central business district. Oh. And it's a really interesting mix of land uses, like warehousing and distributing, printing, the kind of almost support functions for the CBD. So there are lots of jobs along there. There are people who provide the patrons during the lunch hour. It's a really interesting mix of folks. There's the public housing that's been there for a long time. That's kind of a fringe of the central business district function, too. So I think the land use pattern and the social geography really has created what's a wonderful vernacular landscape in Sacramento.
So a lot of forces have combined over a long time to make this global array of restaurants.
Right. It goes all the way back to Broadway emerging from being a levee on the south side of town. It used to be the sort of southern defense against flooding. That was removed in 1918. The streets were paved in the 20s, subdivision started, but there was already this sort of semi-rural industrial food oriented. There are a lot of chicken and turkey farms on that side, dairies. So there's a long history of food association as well, which is kind of nice to see the rural roots in food and then see their kind of urban and global manifestations today.
My goodness, Elaine, how interesting all this is.
Told you. Come up with a story idea, we have to turn it over until you can't see any more sides of it. And through the year, we'll be able to see what Dr. Dowdle's been writing on a website that is dedicated to this project at Capital Radio,
capradio.org.
And we'll be able to see the history of the addresses where we're going. Obviously, we're not going to go to every single restaurant on Broadway, but the ones we select will be respectful to the range, the scope of the cuisines that are there. And as we go through the addresses, Dr. Dowdle will take us through the history of each place.
The series starts tomorrow morning. What restaurant, what cuisine is featured tomorrow?
Right out of the chute, Hong Kong Cafe at 501 Broadway. It is not only a member of many, many Cantonese restaurant community on Broadway, it's the oldest running. And it began actually where Interstate 5 churned up the block. It's a parking, the original location at 320L is now a parking lot under I-5. And when that redevelopment happened, they scurried over to Broadway and took over, now we know the history, Fair's drive-in, an obvious automobile designed place where you could drive up and get a hamburger. And they didn't do much to it. And it's been Hong Kong Cafe since 62.
Let's listen to a clip with a couple of the people who are in your story tomorrow. And they're talking about chop suey, a dish that everyone thinks they know. Before we listen to it, just briefly, Elaine, tell us who Lana Chong and Frank Dong are.
Lana Chong is an active member of the Cantonese community in Sacramento. She's kind of a community organizer, I think, of Lana. She's also a great home cook, puts on lots of festivals and banquets, and is able to discuss her roots very clearly. She's also a member of the Chinese Culture Foundation in Sacramento. Frank Dong is really interesting. If you've ever heard of the restaurant Hong King Lum, its claim to fame, Frank Fat had his first job as a dishwasher at Hong King Lum, and Frank Dong's family, his ancestors, began that restaurant in 1906.
Well, here they are talking about chop suey.
It's basically take a lot of the veggies, stir fry it as quickly as possible, and put it out like the extra dish.
Properly done, it's the use of all these fresh ingredients. It's a very healthy dish and very tasty.
So, Elaine, not quite the dish that people think.
The dish of chop suey we had really claims the phrase accurately. Chop suey means mixed miscellaneous, which is really an anything-goes stir-fry. So if you can put dingy old pork and bean sprouts in a stir-fry, you can put fresh, glistening snow peas, broccoli, bell pepper, and beautiful plump shrimp, which is pretty much what we had that night. It shined and had a beautiful, delicate brown sauce under it. It was mixed miscellaneous. It was what they had on hand, very fresh, made quickly, and pretty nutritious.
Also in your story, we hear from someone called Helen Yee talking about why the Sacramento area was such an appealing place for people from the Pearl River Delta and China. Who's Helen Yee?
Helen Yee is also a member of the Chinese Culture Foundation, and she grew up in Hong Kong, but is a good historian to have around when you're talking about the history of the Cantonese in Sacramento. They were the original gold miners who were sent from this small district along the Pearl River near Hong Kong. And from that little area, they came direct to Sacramento. So the food you find at a place like Hong Kong Cafe seems to me that it traveled intact all those years ago and has remained very true to its origins.
Here's Helen Yee.
In Canton, it's so similar like it's Delta area. Fresh produce, catch fresh fish by the Sacramento River. And the Chinese community is nearby, so they feel comfortable.
Robin Dantle, urban geographer at Sacramento State. Who are these restaurants mainly catering for, do you know? Is it people who share that ethnicity or that national background, or is it catering to a broader range of people?
I think it's a mix. I think there are co-ethnics, as the term would be. So I think when you go in and sit down in the Chinese restaurant or the Ethiopian one, you will see people of those ethnic backgrounds. But again, because of the location of Broadway, one of the spectacular things about it is adjacent to some neighborhoods that are quite different ethnically, and it has that lunchtime business that draws the state worker crowd, including the big DMV facility that's there on Broadway. So I would say it's really a mix of fellow ethnics and other folks.
There's a long tradition of Chinese people and people of Chinese ancestry living around the Broadway area in Sacramento. But you mentioned an Ethiopian restaurant, and Elaine, I think you might be covering that restaurant later. I don't believe there's a long tradition of Ethiopian immigrants in the Broadway area. How does Broadway attract restaurants from around the world that don't have people with a long tradition of being in this area in Sacramento?
Well, I think, the location is a good one because they can play on the established restaurants that are there. So people do think about it a little bit as a place to go, as a restaurant zone. I think the rents are probably right. That's probably a big part of it, that it's, we want to have places in Sacramento that are affordable for small immigrant and non-immigrant entrepreneurs. That's the beauty of a street that looks kind of ordinary. Probably the one landmark on there that everybody knows is the Tower Theater. But other than that, it's physically not spectacular. But that's very much to be treasured because it creates spaces that are affordable.
Elaine, did you eat much in the restaurants in Broadway before you started work on this?
I did. I had my second date with my husband at New Canton over a bowl of war wonton soup, and he was the one who told me what war means. It means the big bowl of wonton soup, so now you know that. I would like to see, if you're not Chinese and you go to Hong Kong Cafe, I would like to see you become a better informed diner. So you might order something that's written in Chinese on the wall and understand that it could be a daily special, and that you'll read the menu a little bit differently and be more adventurous and try these things. For the Chinese at Hong Kong Cafe, it's like home.
I know you're still refining the list of restaurants you're going to cover over the coming year. Tomorrow, Hong Kong Cafe, the Cantonese restaurant. What about next month? Do you know what it's going to be?
I do. We're going to Kathmandu Kitchen. We're going to learn about the cooking of Nepal, distinct from the cooking of India, in a country that is sort of like an upper flap along the northern part of India, but it gets Indian influence on its southern border, but coming down from its top border are Tibet and a Mongol influence. So their cuisine, you think it's Indian-like, but it's all theirs, and it really does speak to who the Nepalese are as a people.
Wow, Robin, this work's enough to make you hungry, isn't it?
It certainly is.
Well, Elaine Korn's series, Broadway Around the World in 30 Blocks, starts tomorrow during Morning Edition at 6:33 and 8:33, and it continues on the second Friday of every month through next November. There's a link in our webpage, capradio.org/insight, to Elaine's bio and all of her recent stories for Capital Public Radio. So thanks to Elaine Korn, food reporter for Capital Public Radio, and Robin Dattle, who's collaborating with Elaine on this series. Robin is an urban geographer in the Geography Department at Sacramento State. Thank you both very much.
Thanks
for having us.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, jazz clarinetist and saxophonist Anat Cohen. She and her band are playing Davis this week. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can get a daily RSS feed telling you what's on the next edition of Insight. Sign up at capradio.org/insight. Coming up this afternoon from Capital Public Radio News, a big winter storm heading to our area. Plus, California air regulators voting tomorrow on a controversial plan to significantly reduce diesel exhaust emissions. Those stories and more are later today on All Things Considered. Jazz clarinetist, saxophonist, and composer Anat Cohen is in town this week for a series of concerts. Her music is influenced by modern and traditional jazz, along with various kinds of Latin music, classical music, and klezmer. Born in Israel, Cohen now lives in New York City. She's in our studio, along with guitarist Gilad Hexelman. Anat Cohen, Gilad Hexelman, welcome to Insight.
Hi, Jeffrey. Thank you. It's great to be here.
Hey, Jeffrey.
Anat, you play both the clarinet and the saxophone. Which came first?
The clarinet came first, saxophone came after, and now the clarinet is becoming dominant again.
I see. Well, why did you pick up the sax then, if you already had one instrument?
I heard people like Sonny Rollins, Dexter Gordon, John Coltrane. I fell in love with the tenor saxophone. I wanted to know more about jazz, about the history of this music. But in the last few years, I got to play a lot of different kinds of music, more folkloric, more traditional. The clarinet just fits perfectly with all those styles, and I started to look for my own way of playing and incorporate it with my own music. So the clarinet is dominant again in jazz in my life.
What kind of music did you start out playing?
Well, actually, the first jazz I ever played was Dixieland Band, but I was classically trained as a clarinetist, doing the classical routine. But once I started to play the saxophone and I started to play jazz, it became the main thing in my life.
Was all this in Israel?
That was all in Israel.
Yeah. So you were playing Dixieland in Israel?
Oh, yeah.
Is Dixieland big in Israel?
Oh, it's very big. Well, at least in the conservatory where I took some lessons in.
Where was that?
That was the Tel Aviv Jaffa Conservatory. It's right outside of Tel Aviv.
Yeah. Why is Dixieland taught in the conservatory in Tel Aviv?
Well, I was wondering the same thing. I think we were just very fortunate to have one of the teachers in the conservatory that had passion for the tradition of jazz, for the big band tradition, for the Dixieland, New Orleans music. He played it himself, and he created Dixieland band that rehearsed twice a week in the conservatory and a big band rehearsal every Friday. So we were very lucky to actually take some jazz ensembles as young kids.
Well, we're going to ask you to play something for us, but first let's just check in with guitarist Gilad Hexelman. Gilad, are you first and foremost a jazz musician?
Yeah, I would say that.
Yeah. Is that what you started out with when you were young?
No, I started out, some piano, some classical piano, and then some drums, attempt to play drums until my neighbor wouldn't take it anymore. and then I picked up on the guitar, but then I was starting only playing rock music for years, and only when I went to high school, the same high school that I went to, Thelma Aline High School of Arts.
That's in Israel?
That's when I started learning about jazz music.
So you two have known each other for a long time.
Yes, we definitely, Gilad is just a bit younger than me. So he was, I met him on one of my visits in Israel after living in the States.
And I started as a fan and became a sideman.
Well, Gilad has his guitar, and we're going to hear from you both. What are you going to play?
Well, since I have my clarinet in my hand, let's play a song that Benny Goodman made famous. It's called Lullaby of the Leaves.
Very nice. We'll look forward to it. So, Anat Cohen and Gilad Hexelman live in our studio. Wow, that was wonderful. Lullaby of the Leaves, played live in our studio by Anat Cohen, clarinetist, and Gilad Hexelman, guitarist, who's playing with Anat. Anat is here with the band, playing Davis this week at the Mandavi Center Studio Theater. They started last night, a 4-week residency. They're here through Saturday.
Gilad, it seemed like you weren't playing chords. You were almost more like a bass guitar in a way there. How do you decide what kind of guitar you're going to add to something that Annette is soloing on?
It's just that in this kind of setting, when it's a duet, and especially since Annette and I have such a strong linear connection, and we can go many places in terms of textures and lines, I just chose to play more lines with her.
Yes.
Rather than, you know, sticking to the guitar, or like the old-fashioned guitar part.
Our listeners obviously can't see what you were doing, but it was very playful to watch. There were a couple of times when you almost stopped and smiled at each other. Is that because it's a fun piece to play?
It's a fun piece to play, and we, you know, since we are improvising, then there are always unexpected moments, and we like to keep it enjoyable, to keep it playful, and to smile. And it's like a game we're playing with music, so we're smiling at each other.
Usually when people are playing the clarinet, they're playing, you know, they're holding down the keys with the tips of the fingers, but near the end you were bouncing the palm of your hand off one of the keys.
Yeah, I was trying to get this like a little jumping effect.
Yeah, it's a very nice sound.
Thank you.
That song is not on your album Notes from the Village, isn't that right?
That is not correct.
Let's listen to a clip of a song that is from the album. This is a song that you wrote called Washington Square Park. Annette, how do you approach writing songs?
Well, I usually go to the piano and I write it on the piano. And
even though you're known as a clarinetist and saxophonist?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Well, it's easy because the piano, unlike the guitar, it's all visual. You look and it's easier to see the directions where the line go up, the line go down. There's the chords in one hand, the melody in another hand. So it makes it a little easier. And sometimes I'm influenced by things I hear. Many times I'm influenced by things I hear. Sometimes I try to write something in a specific style. If I go to Venezuela and I hear a certain rhythm, and I go home and I try to write something in the same theme and the same rhythm. And sometimes I think I write something that I didn't hear. Many times it comes out. It's somewhere all inside me. It's being cooked in the soup of sounds that I heard all over my life, all through my life.
You've obviously been influenced by lots of genres of music, but it's still jazz, isn't it?
Well, for me, it's jazz because it's music that is made, being created in the moment and is being improvised, and there is interaction between the musicians, and the music is flexible. It can go wherever the moment wants to take it. So for me, this is what jazz is. It's...
I want to make sure we have time, which we do, for one more song in our studio. What's this going to be?
I think we're going to play a song that is from the album, from Notes from the Village, that came out on Enzik Records. The song is called J-Blues, that I wrote for a piano player that I play a lot with and I'm a big fan of. His name is Jason Lindner. Jason has this beautiful world approach, and he embraces any music that he hears. So I wrote J-Blues for him.
Great. Well, we'll look forward to it. Annette Cohen and Gilad Hexelman live in our studio. Thank you. wonderful J-Blues played live in our studio by Anat Cohen and Gilad Hexelman. Anat and her band are playing Davis this week through Saturday night at the Studio Theatre at the Mandavi Centre. That was great, the squealing notes that came out towards the end. It was like you're twisting the instrument, but it was still straight and long like a clarinet.
Yeah, I like to be playful with the sounds and to use it not only in the legit way that clarinet, the classical clarinet players use the clarinet. I like to use all kinds of bending notes techniques.
You live in New York, but as we said earlier, you're from Israel, and we'll have to do this very quickly, but you did your military service, but in a musical way.
Yes. Thank you for making the answer short for me. Yes. Boot camp, short one, and 2 years in the Air Force Big Band. So that was quite an experience.
Playing the sax?
Playing the saxophone and the clarinet.
Jazz?
Pop. Wow. You know, all the Israeli singers, they have to do their reserve army until they're 55 years old. So they go and they perform, and as the Air Force Big Band, we accompany them with whatever style they sing in. So it would be more pop.
And Gila, do you live in New York too now?
Uh-huh, yep, you do. In Brooklyn.
Okay, very good. Well, it was nice to meet you both. Thank you so much for playing in our studio. I have it in good authority that last night's first concert at Mandavi was a big success. So I wish you the best for the remainder of the run at the Mandavi Center.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Anat Cohen and guitarist Gilad Hexelman. That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. For more on the guests and topics you hear on Insight, go to our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Today's associate producer was Nathan Wilkinson. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Today's engineer, Evan Matzler. Today's program director, John Bernaysi. Our senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us. Just published its new flood maps for Sacramento's Natomas Basin, and that means higher flood insurance for many people there. On the next Insight, we'll talk about this with Sacramento's top flood control official. Also, why bird watchers here and across the country go out one morning every December to count as many birds as they can. And playwright Sands Hall, her adaptation of Little Women is in Nevada City. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow afternoon at 2 on KXJZ.